In the end, Patton's poem is more Roman than Jewish, because it was the Romans who saw war as eternal. Jews, in contrast, understood the importance of war, insisted that some things were worth fighting for. But at the same time, there were prophets who spoke of an age where swords would be beaten into plowshares and all the nations of the world would turn with reverence toward Jerusalem. Welcome to Jerusalem 365, episode 85, the first Jewish victory and the true lesson of Hanukkah. I'm Meir Soloveitchik. Through a Glass Darkly is the title of a poem by General George Patton, one which was featured in the Oscar-winning film with George C. Scott. Patton visualizes himself, reincarnated in war after war, experiencing battle again and again. Here are several selected passages. I have sinned and I have suffered, played the hero and the knave, fought for belly, shame, or country, and for each have found a grave. While in later clearer vision I can sense the coppery sweat, feel the pikes grow wet and slippery when our phalanx, Cyrus, met. Still more clearly as a Roman can I see the legion close as our third rank moved in forward and the short sword found our foes. So as through a glass and darkly the age-old strife I see where I fought in many guises, many names, but always me. Jews, in a somewhat similar sense, envision themselves as re-experiencing events in previous generations, though their focus is on the redemptive moments that were wrought by the hand of God. For example, in every generation, one is obligated to see oneself as if he had left Egypt. Yet there is no question that the Jews of Judea in the year 66 CE knew well the sites of former battles in the Holy Land, and they found therein inspiration for the future. It's therefore striking that the first genuine engagement between Rome and the Jewish rebels took place at a site of victories previously achieved by Judah the Maccabee. Having achieved success there as well, the Jewish rebels against Rome must have thought that a second Hanukkah was at hand. But the rebels would have to learn that, as many note, while history seems to rhyme, it does not repeat itself exactly, and moreover, that in seeking inspiration from the Hanukkah story, they may have been overlooking the most important lesson of all. In continuing to tell the story of the Jewish revolt, I am drawing on Josephus, as well as three very different but very excellent contemporary books. A Temple in Flames by Bar Kochba and Horowitz, which I mentioned yesterday, Rome and Jerusalem by the historian Martin Goodman, and the excellent military history of the revolt for the Freedom of Zion by Guy McLean Rogers. Following the expulsion of the Romans from Jerusalem, the Roman governor of Syria, Cestius Gallus, set out with a large army to retake Judea. He rampaged through the Galilee and eventually arrived at the city of Lydda, known today as Lod, near the Ben-Gurion airport. And he found that the Jews there had largely gone off to celebrate Sukkot in Jerusalem. Cestius Gallus massacred the Jews that remained and then set out to the sacred city. And here geography becomes incredibly important. I cite from Roger's book, quote, "Since all routes from Lydda to Jerusalem would have required making an ascent up the Judean hills onto the plateau, Cestius probably took the road from Lydda to Gabaon that passes just south of Modin, the hometown of the Maccabees, because it was the most direct of all alternatives and involved a steep climb, some 755 feet, along a narrow road only from lower Beit Horon to upper Beit Horon, about 2 miles away, following roughly the route of the modern Highway 443 in Israel. It was obviously in Cestius's interest to make sure that the column spent as little time as possible marching along the most vulnerable section of the route. Cestius therefore confidently ascended some 755 feet up through the narrow and steep pass between lower Beit Horon and upper Beit Horon. In places the pass was less than 10 feet wide before Roman military engineers widened it. After reaching upper Beit Horon, Cestius then proceeded about 5.6 miles southeastward to the hill of Gabaon, where he encamped on the evening of the day after he left Lydda." End quote. Here we must speak of the Pass of Beit Horon, a narrow pass leading to and from Jerusalem, and well known to the Jews of Jerusalem, for there was achieved one of the valiant victories of Judah the Maccabee against the Seleucid general Seron. The Book of Maccabees reports, quote, "At ascent of Beit Horon, Judah went out to meet him with a small company, but when they saw the army coming to meet them, they said to Judah, 'How can we, few as we are, fight against so great and so strong a multitude? And we are faint, for we have eaten nothing today.' Judah replied, "It is easy for many to be hemmed in by few, for in the sight of heaven there is no difference between saving by many or by few. It is not on the size of the army that victory in battle depends, but strength comes from heaven. They come against us in great insolence and lawlessness to destroy us and our wives and our children and to despoil us. But we fight for our lives and our laws. He himself will crush them before us. As for you, do not be afraid of them." When he finished speaking, he rushed suddenly against Seron and his army, and they were crushed before him. They pursued them down the descent of Beth Horon to the plain. 800 of them fell, and the rest fled into the land of the Philistines. End quote. This passage, describing the battle at Beth Horon, marks all that made Judah so remarkable. Utilizing the narrow nature of the area in a strategic maneuver, when even a large army is vulnerable in so small a space, Judah manifests military brilliance, while also, and even more importantly, relying on God for the victory and giving God the glory for it. Here too, in 66 CE, the rebels utilized the advantage of the narrow straits. As Gallus' army ascended away from the pass, already, according to Josephus, reaching the encampment, with the Roman line over 6 miles long, extending back into the pass, Jews launched a frontal attack, and then rebels raided the back of the Roman line. This latter raid was led by a rebel whom we shall meet again soon, Shimon bar Giora, and the name is noteworthy. As many point out, Giora is the equivalent of Ger, convert, signifying how some of the fiercest warriors were themselves of convert families. Thus, another well-known fighter from the rebels was of the family of Queen Helene of Abedi, highlighting how Jerusalem at this time drew converts from various places on earth. After this Jewish attack, Gallus made his way into Jerusalem, burning the extended suburb and taking residence in the upper city. At this point, Rogers writes, quote, "Cestius was confronted by a recently successful and motivated enemy that was preparing to fight on its own turf, supported by at least a sizable proportion of the civilian population. Some kind of siege was the obvious military solution to the situation, but conducting a siege at the time involved insurmountable problems. Cestius and his army were in no position to carry out a successful siege of the temple and the city. Cestius did not have enough boots, caligae, or ballistae catapults with him to conduct a siege in October 66. That was the wrong time of year to begin a siege that inevitably would require securing material and food resources from the surrounding area. Soon enough it would be winter, a time of rain and cold on the Judean plateau," end quote. Cestius therefore decided to lead a direct attack on the temple complex. His soldiers formed the much-feared formation known as the testuo, the tortoise, describing how shields are utilized in order to create a sort of shell around members of the Roman legions. The temple gate was assaulted and set on fire, and then, suddenly, Cestius Gallus retreated. This is a moment over which historians puzzle to this day. Josephus argues that had Cestius Gallus pressed the attack, he would have won, and suggests that bribery inspired the retreat. This is discounted by modern historians. Martin Goodman suggests that, quote, "Perhaps Cestius thought he could stop because he had already achieved enough. He had demonstrated clearly the power of Rome by marching right up to the gates of the temple, spreading devastation around him," end quote. Rogers, in his book For the Freedom of Zion, suggests the opposite, that Cestius realized that he did not have the supplies to feed an army of 30,000 men, and that a much larger force was required for the besieging of Jerusalem. Be that as it may, Cestius Gallus did retreat, and as he retreated, the Jews attacked all the way. Then Cestius Gallus led his army through the very same way he came, the Beit Horon Pass. Again, the Jews took advantage of the terrain, blocking the way through which the Romans were to exit, while another group of rebels attacked from the rear, driving the Romans into the pass. Rogers succinctly summarizes what occurred after this. Quote, "The main body of the Jews meanwhile lined the high ground above Cestius's men and rained arrows down on them. While the infantry had a hard time defending itself on the uneven and precipitous ground, the cavalrymen were virtually defenseless, and many of the horses and their riders slipped off the path and fell to their deaths into the steep ravines," end quote. This is known as Clades Cestiana, the disaster of Cestius, one that the Roman leader only survived by retreating secretly during the night. And we must look at this moment from the perspective of the rebels. They had won a victory at the same site as a famous battle by the Maccabees. They did so near Modin, from where the Maccabees had themselves arisen. The battle took place on Sukkot, a holiday linked, as we have seen, to the Hasmonean story. How could they not look back on history and relive the moment when Judah Maccabee said, "It is not the size of the army that victory in battle depends, but strength comes from heaven. They come against us in great insolence and lawlessness to destroy us and our wives and our children and to despoil us, but we fight for our lives and our laws." So Judah is reported to have said, and the Jewish rebels against Rome might have spoken similarly to themselves. In contrast, as Rogers notes, those on the Roman side had not read the history of Judea. Quote, "Neither Cestius nor Agrippa apparently had heard or read about Seron, the governor of Coel Syria, and his defeat by Judas Maccabeus along the same route some 230 years earlier. And they underestimated the fighting spirit and quality of the rebels. In fact, during the rest of the war, Roman commanders consistently underestimated the morale of their adversaries." However, Rogers also adds, "The rebels, meanwhile, seem to have misunderstood the significance of their victory over Cestius. Throughout their history, the Romans had lost most of the battles at the beginning of wars. In many wars, they had lost almost all of the early battles, but they almost always won the last and decisive battle. The Roman response to defeat was defiance, and in victory, they were not magnanimous." End quote. This is true, but there's a larger lesson to be learned, I think, from history and from Hanukkah, one which the rebels against Rome forgot. Looking back on the Bible, we can note how so many families important to Jewish history were marked by discord, with profound repercussions for the Jewish future. There is, of course, the tale of Joseph's kidnapping by his brothers. Then, centuries later, after David conquered and settled Jerusalem, his own family was torn apart in the stories of Amnon and Avshalom, Avshalom and David, Solomon and Adoniah. The one exception is Moses and Aaron. And then, following the biblical period, in the Second Temple, we find another, the family of Mattathias, the Hasmoneans, made up of a father and five sons that show remarkable unity with not a single hint of rivalry or discord in the first generation. And thereby, through that unity, was victory achieved. The same, sadly, cannot be said for those that led Jerusalem in 66 until its fall in the year 70. Had the Jewish leadership at this moment of victory at Beth Horon covenanted in unity and led in unity, there is no telling what might have happened, as this victory precisely preceded a period when political disunity was about to inflict imperial Rome. But unity is not what was achieved in Jerusalem, and further battles and defeats were to follow. Patton, in his poem's conclusion, imagines himself reliving endless war, writing, "And I see not in my blindness what the objects were I wrought, but as God rules o'er our bickerings, it was through his will I fought. So forever in the future shall I battle as of yore, dying to be born a fighter, but to die again once more." In the end, Patton's poem is more Roman than Jewish, because it was the Romans who saw war as eternal. Jews, in contrast, as Martin Goodman notes, understood the importance of war, insisted that some things were worth fighting for. But at the same time, there were prophets who spoke of an age where swords would be beaten into plowshares, spears into pruning hooks, and all the nations of the world would turn with reverence toward Jerusalem. But that prophecy is to be fulfilled in the redemptive future, and the prophets, in their visions, also stressed the unity of the chosen people as what ought to shine forth from Jerusalem, predicting that ultimately Ephraim lo yikaneh et Yehuda, v'Yehuda lo yikaneh et Ephraim. Judah and Ephraim would be envious of each other no more. We keep this ideal in mind as we continue to tell the story of a Jewish city that experienced so many battles, a Jewish city that will never die. This is Meir Soloveitchik. Look forward to learning together tomorrow. Wishing you a luminous Hanukkah. Signing off.